Welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy because now everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is Paul Glover from paulglover.org. Paul, are you there? Welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny.
How are you, my friend?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Somewhat fabulous is my standard response.
Considering, yes.
Yes.
The world we live in.
Well, I don't know. How about where we start is we get you to explain to the audience and, of course, myself, just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, you've invited me on the show, I think, because I've taken a number of initiatives over the many years on behalf proving that ecology and social justice are practical priorities for society. I've started organizations, about 18 organizations and campaigns that transfer control over food, fuel, housing, healthcare, planning, education, transportation, and finance to grassroots entities and decentralize authority on behalf of community and nature. Among these are Ithaca Hours, a local currency that started 22 years ago that has transacted millions of dollars of value in that small city. It's currency that I designed on my computer and spent the next several years convincing people in the community, several thousand individuals and over 500 businesses, that it was real money. And we've made grants to over 100 community organizations and loans up to $30,000 without charging interest. I started a health co-op for the uninsured in Ithaca. As you know, in the United States is not altogether a civilized nation. People have to pay for access to health care out of pocket or through the paycheck in considerable amounts. So did those in Ithaca and have moved since then to Philadelphia, a rust belt city with 350,000 unemployed, 275,000 uninsured with no health access, 60,000 chronically hungry children, 40,000 vacant lots, and is the world capital of incarceration with the highest rate of incarceration of all cities in the world. It's hog heaven for an urban ecologist, and that is my field, to translate, to weave nature back into cities.
Okay. And are you by chance advocating any form of, shall we say, rigid governmental change, you know, like getting, how can I say this? Getting the federal government out of people's lives and instead getting volunteers to start doing the work that the government's kind of doing by itself at the moment.
Oh, indeed. To the extent that we take responsibility and control within our communities and within our regions, we decrease our dependence on national and global entities for providing us with the necessities of everyday life, and they are not doing a very good job of that. So the need is evident to more and more people every day. In the United States, there are millions of organizations which are seeking to do exactly this. And these organizations, these entities, these initiatives, both for-profit and especially non-profit, create what I consider a mutual enterprise economy, which is neither strictly capitalist nor strictly socialist, kind of anarchist, but within government of necessity, that meet needs without depending on distant boardrooms or distant legislatures. An immense amount of activity of this sort is evident in Philadelphia and very proud to be part of this range of efforts here. But again, as, throughout the globe, there are plenty of initiatives that prove the practicability of grassroots control of everyday life.
Now, can I ask as well, the other elements is that there's, I feel, there's two green movements now. There's the real green movement that actually wants to take whatever we've got and simply make it less harmful and more sustainable, and the other green movement who think that any form of pollution or any form of encroachment on nature is evil and people need to be enslaved and contained in hardcore super sustainable cities and have all their freedoms and rights taken off them.
I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. I drafted a scenario about 30 years ago for Los Angeles. I went there because it was the worst case. The triumphant consumerism, America, we pave, we go fast, we throw things away. This is America. I went there deliberately because Los Angeles had achieved that pinnacle and was the broadcast to the world of that standard of living to prove that there was a different pathway. And that green pathway would enable us to retain our independence as individuals by rebuilding the city entirely over many decades toward balance with nature. I wrote a book titled Los Angeles, A History of the Future. And America desperately needs ideas and images of a new pathway beyond what seems to be, for more and more people, a dead end in this country. Our idea of progress and growth, of success and a good life, has been broadcast throughout the world and is replicated woefully extensively. So my book described a process by which over, as I say, many decades, we could employ everyone in what are known as green jobs to rebuild the city so that it needed virtually no fossil fuel, so that it produced within the region nearly all of its food and fuel, and in which people had the greatest autonomy and the greatest creativity in job development. That is to say, instead of working in cubicles for companies remote from us and our needs, we were creating for one another. Those things which were beautiful to us and a delight to trade with one.
Well, can I also say that the main ethos, I think, about any form of government tends to be about making sure that people are accepting of the changes rather than simply being pushed or forced into it. And if they won't accept, they can opt out, sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. Voluntary associations are the essence of the anarchism, the kind of anarchism that I have promoted, the voluntary organizations that appeal to people, saying we can do it better together. Your beauty and your creativity can combine in such a way as to meet our needs with least overhead, with least bureaucracy. And to me that is the best idea of a good economy and a good society. Our marketplaces are real places where we meet each other as friends and lovers and political allies, rather than global abstractions where we trade digits, literally at the speed of light, without any regard for the effect of that transaction, those transactions on ecology, on the planet. or on community. And I started the local currency Ithaca Hours in 1991 deliberately to transfer control over money and what money does to the community, entirely to expand that part of the marketplace, which was a genuine geographic place, that enabled us to become a community, to create community, to make a living while making a community. And that was very successful for many years. It needs a renewal, a networking process, a very intensive network process to reinflate it to its peak capacity. And as I mentioned, in the United States, we don't have a national health plan. Everybody has to scramble and pay out a big part of their paycheck if they have enough for health care, and in this country, 50 million do not. I started a renegade health plan. People paid $100 per year, and they could use Ithaca Hours, local currency, as part of that, to own and control a health plan, which provided them, to the extent we developed it, for 12 categories of everyday emergency anywhere in the world to specified maximum amounts, and today they own their own pre-clinic. That component of ownership is very important. We do not depend and wait around for the goodness of government, nor for the generosity of the corporate state.
I would say that if you are waiting around for the government to become good and the corporations to become generous, you'd be waiting a very long time.
We are both speaking ironically.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed. The process of taking control locally and regionally requires of us all responsibility. That is to say, it is fairly easier to critique and condemn the capital they who are greedy and violent and corrupt. They are all over the place. They are, since human society began, there has always been they who are greedy, corrupt, and violent. But to assert our responsibility and capability to be a generous and loving counterpart to them is a great challenge to us all, and a challenge that I have welcomed. And that millions are actively engaged in worldwide.
Do you think any of these people in the government or the banking industry might be a little unhappy about what you're doing and basically encouraging people to take personal responsibility as opposed to being encouraged to be dependent on companies and governments that they basically have no control over, including the legislature?
Well, it's been curious that the local currency that I started, as I say, that had transacted millions of dollars value, was never challenged by the government, and in fact was endorsed by the government. Now, I explained to them that, in fact, the national economies and the national currencies, which are all backed by debt, it depends for their vitality on the vitality of village, neighborhood, and urban economies. For some reason, they never shut us down. I assumed it was illegal, which was part of the fun, but they never did. When I started the health co-op, though, because there is a monopoly on health insurance in this country, they did try to shut us down, and we growled at each other for a year and a half, and I finally made a threat to them, which was nonviolent and legal but terrifying to them, and they backed down. I threatened to run for governor of New York State on the Green Party line, and gaining 50,000 votes would have gained for us permanent ballot status, which would have meant we could have tilted the balance of power from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. We would have spoiled their election. You can't spoil something that's rotten, but we would have spoiled the Democratic majority in New York State, and they were scared of that, so they backed down. At any rate, indeed, there is an extent to which within government there are people who, as bureaucrats, are dull and clueless, and also among them people who are excited to do something different and who share our values, though they are in government. So I look around for the doors that are ready to crack open. But I do not wait around or expect or depend on their generosity and open-mindedness. I've written a book titled How to Take Power. I've written several books. That's one of them.
Well, hold on. We've come into break now, Paul. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Paul Glover. His website is paulglover.org. Back in a minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We do a public service of basically interviewing anybody you listeners ask for. Somebody asked for Paul Glover, so we've got him on here at paulglover.org. Paul, welcome back.
Hello, Vinnie.
See, here's the great thing that I like about you is that you really come in at this green angle from an angle that I like and I think is actually quite brilliant, really. Is because you're cutting through the bureaucracy, cutting through the BS, and simply solving the problems person by person, neighborhood by neighborhood. You know, if you do a whole lot of small things, they add up to a lot.
The intent is to set examples, to create models that prove the practicability of local control, of grassroots control, that bring forward the beauty and creativity of average people. Rather than dependence, ownership, and I think that attitude and the proof of the capability that we each have, and collaboratively that we have, is the essence and foundation of a society which is healthy. My broadest aim. And that which gets me up in the morning is that cities, particularly, become as beautiful as the children within them. Cities are full of beautiful children, and they deserve cities as beautiful as they are. I haven't been to Auckland. There are a lot of places that I have not been, cities which are beautiful. And I mean beautiful not only in the sense of lovely architecture and flowers, but I mean in the sense of being ecologically sustainable, that engage the capability of each and every person. And American cities outstandingly have become cities which are dedicated more to consumerism than to creating.
And do you feel that if people don't have that sort of that creation, that community involvement in their life, that there's really personal nasty consequences, like turning to crime, drugs, something of that nature?
Oh, indeed. That the purpose of life to me is that creativity be released and celebrated. And our contemporary cultures, our contemporary media in general, celebrate a few funny people, a few artistic people. And put the rest of us in shade to merely be entertained. And I look forward to that, and to the development, to the redevelop of a civilization and a society that engage that beauty and creativity, not just to entertain, but to inspire and activate the rebuilding of society so that it does not depend on the consumption of the essential resources of nature, but replenishes nature and is beautiful at the same time. It's all order, but I think nothing less is required and expected of us on behalf of the next generation. So for me, life is not about how much I can buy going shopping. It is about how much I can help and foster, create on behalf of indefinite future generations. To me, that is much more central to the purpose of life. And a glorious, if I can use that word, national project. I mentioned that the United States has been so outstandingly effective at distributing a culture globally, the standards of success that have been adopted so vastly. We need to broadcast from our country a new standard of success, which is that creativity, not how much, as I say, we can buy, how much we can create.
Can I ask as well, your personal story and coming through all this, you've been active in these sorts of areas and community activism, creating green jobs. We've got the Patch Adams Health Care Clinic here. You've basically got a long list of things that you've done. I'm wondering how you grew up and what got you started being interested in all of this. Like, what did your parents do?
Well, I was raised in a very standard manner in the suburbs of an American city, and had no worries about food, had no worries about anything. And the Vietnam War came along and snapped a lot of us to attention and required of us to engage history, that is to say, to justify whether we would or would not participate in the expansion of an American empire. And the challenge was raised to us, if you are so against this war and this empire, what are you for? And so I have been, since then, very active in defining what I was for. I was raised close to nature, and that beauty of nature, and the desire that everyone and every child particularly enjoy connection with that beauty of nature has stayed with me. And I do not know why it has been so tenacious within me that all problems can be solved. If they can't be solved, well, then we might as well just all die. And I have instead insisted that they can all be solved. And I have sought to prove that. And as I said at the very beginning, millions of organizations, initiatives, worldwide, are proving the practicability of alternatives. They are not headline news. They are not front page. But they are happening. The world is getting better at the same time that it's getting worse.
Yeah, that's my philosophy. Everything gets better and worse at the same time. I mean, what was it? There was an early lesson in geography, actually. You know how waves come and dump on the beach and they take out sand and stuff like that, yet somehow more sand comes back. And it's called dynamic equilibrium. It doesn't matter how big the process of destruction is going, there's always a process of creation going on just underneath it that replaces it and keeps everything in balance. And I'm coming to the conclusion now that humanity's sort of becoming conscious of their own part to play in this dynamic equilibrium and are deciding to become the force of creation rather than the force of destruction that's happening right now
and using intense creativity to accomplish these things. I just read this morning that there is a crowdsourcing project for a guy who's created a rather large vessel, or the plans for one anyway, that has enormous catchment booms on the sides of it, and they want to clean up the world's oceans of all that soupy type plastic that's basically wobbling around out there in 5 years. And I thought, man, what a brilliant idea, because I've seen how much waste has been dumped into the oceans at a point where you can dunk a small fishing net in the water in the middle of the ocean and pick up little chunks of plastic. It's horrific. And yet now we've got the ability and the inclination to change it. It's the same thing, isn't it?
Indeed. There are historic cycles where things get worse and things get better, where people suffer horrid indignities and devastation, and then they rebel against those. They have revolutions, sometimes which redress the problems or which replace the people at the top. And the technologies are being invented. Amazing, beautiful things are happening. And that the challenge is that they become ascendant. And that is an age-old question. That is, within every society, there are people who want to control and dominate and will seek to do so regardless of the damage and doom that they inflict on society, notwithstanding that they themselves will be consumed in the inevitable ensuing revolution. So, to smooth out that cycle of devastation and revolution, to foster nonviolent social change, these technologies knock on the door and say, we can do the job. And some of them are green jobs, green technologies. Some of them are deep green jobs. And I distinguish between these, between green jobs and deep green jobs. Green jobs kind of palliate and reduce the damage done, the extent of it, while the damage continues. And the deep green jobs entirely replace the damage that is done. And that's why I return to this theme of creating rather than consuming. We are raised to believe that our destiny and our definition of success personally is the extent to which we can buy stuff. I personally own nothing. I do have a laptop and a bicycle, but I have made a deliberate decision a long time ago to own nothing. I have enough clothes to be legal and to not smell bad. But it has been far more exciting to me to participate in and initiate social organizations that prove the practicability of human compatibility with the planet Earth. So, yes, sir, yes, it's been a lot of fun.
And your personal journey of all of this, you must have seen some amazing sort of examples of humanity out there. Who were some of the people you admire?
Well, there are famous people I admire. Gosh, in the United States, Ralph Nader, Thoreau, and yes, a good range of famous people. But I admire people who are raising families or living a life of reasonable and modest material dignity while at the same time putting main effort and maintaining a faith in the capability of people to create communities that are compatible with nature, and in which everybody has an equal chance at a life of dignity.
Well, it seems that dignity around the United States seems to be getting taken away at every look and turn, isn't it? I mean, isn't that what the TSA is about? To take away your dignity?
Oh, and your breast milk? Yeah. It's a recurring historic cycle. We've seen this whenever there has been a challenge to the prevailing authority. They have whipped the public into a frenzy of acceptance of tyranny, whether it has been anarchists, communists, socialists, terrorists. And that is a prevailing idea in the United States at this time. At the same time, there's a huge amount of pushback. People are aware, because they are aware of the history of what are known as false flags, that the government will capitalize, will take advantage of violence within the country to clamp down on civil liberties. So, that's happening. But it's happened before. It's a recurring cycle. And I think that is very important to me. Among other things, I have written urban histories, and I have an understanding of the broad cycles of history. And that sustains me as well, that bad things happen, they become a sense, and then they are pushed back. And
are you following, by chance, examples that have happened throughout history of how to push back tyranny or social degradation? Or are you creating a whole new one?
That's a very good question. The intent is to learn as many lessons of history as one may in order to create examples which most effectively moderate, decrease the extreme cycle of oppression and revolution. So, I have focused on the idea that people in general can and should control money and land and law, and how we may, in the midst of the worst domination and oppression and degradation, take that control back again.
All right, and we'll be right back from break in a minute.
Look at me, driving and I won't stop. And it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach is global, my tower secure. My cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from lacerations, have them all killed by assassination.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You, the listeners, are the fuel for this show, and I'm simply the man behind the curtain, pulling all the levers and making the flame shoot out and stuff. A very special guest is Paul Glover from paulglover.org. And I wanted you to actually finish up. I asked you before the break about whether or not you're copying other historical examples of what has worked throughout history to oppose tyranny and environmental degradation and applying it to today, or whether you're coming up with entirely new systems based upon our new understanding in the current world. Paul, are you there? Seem to have lost him. That's great. Okay. Well, while we're busy getting him up, there's something else that I wanted to remind people of, as well as the fact that I'm just kind of working really hard now to get these new types of Vinnie Eastwood Show videos up on the YouTube channel. We're using a little HD camera filming during the show each day and popping in the pictures of the guests as well, and I hope people really appreciate and enjoy that. It takes like about twice as long as the older versions, which are a bit lower quality, but yeah, it's pretty cool, man. I reckon if you got technology, freaking use it, you know, add some value to it. Speaking of value, we're in real financial trouble here in the homestead of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Next week's rent, I don't think we're going to be able to afford it. So if there's anybody else out there with $5 a month they could spare, and go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, subscribe, give us a monthly donation. So that way, if we've got a regular income from the listeners that we serve on this show, we'll basically keep going forever and ever and continue to produce some high quality and highly entertaining content for you. And we very much appreciate all of the donations and subscriptions that have come in thus far. I do recall that we had a big problem with PayPal that kind of wiped me out, and I'm still wiped out because of it. Many of the people who used to be subscribers to the show for between $1 and $20 a month all had to cancel their subscriptions because that old account wasn't working. That was under the infectiousfilms@gmail.com email. That one's no longer active. I won't be able to access any of the funds in that for another 180 days. The new PayPal is gorillamedia911@gmail.com. That's the PayPal one there. So if you could have a check back. If you were a subscriber in the past, and I think there was about 90 of you that cancelled when we had these PayPal problems, so you're still listening to the show, but very few of those people have actually resubscribed. So I'm doing a very specific call out to you. If you have previously been a subscriber to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, thank you very much for doing so and continue to enjoy those ad-free archives. And if you have not resubscribed, please do, because we need those subscriptions and donations right now to pay the rent next week. It's a real frustrating scenario, and of course, I know everybody else feels this way from time to time. You just don't know how you're going to get through the next week, and that's how I'm going right now. It's pretty harsh, so any support would be very, very much greatly appreciated. Okay, now, American Freedom Radio, are we getting Paul Glover back up soon by any chance? Is he there? No? Okay. Well, let's try and get him back up. I don't think the studio is responding. I know everybody can hear me. So, all right. Now, the other element. Wait. Here we are. Paul, are you back?
Hey.
All right. What happened there?
I don't know.
Oh, well, it's inconsequential.
Satellite.
Anyway, getting on to it, there was a question I asked you before the break about all these historical instances that have happened where people kind of get used to and start demanding tyranny, and then eventually that tyranny gets overthrown by somebody somehow. And I presume in the past, environmental degradation has really come into it as well. You know, the environment being destroyed through war or the salting of fields and things of that nature under the Romans. And I was just wondering, are you coming up with all new methodologies for reversing these very simple and commonly reoccurring historical symptoms, or are you basically updating previous methodologies that have worked to overthrow tyranny and restore the environment in the past?
Yes, I mentioned that my initiatives are, of course, based on historic precedent, but tweak it and to create novelties for our time. More broadly, I think that we have developed a middle-class idea and an ideal of success, personal achievement, and the good life, which are counterproductive. And so I have written an article titled From the Middle Class to the Mutual Class. The middle class has become more concerned with its properties than its liberties, has become more preoccupied with consuming, creating. And a mutual class gets off of the treadmill of dependence on banks and shopping malls and mortgages and student loans by creating non-profit, genuinely non-profit alternatives to all of these. And food, of course, as well. That through these processes, we become autonomous again. We become communities again, which are least dependent on external supplies, least dependent on external authorities for the meeting of our basic needs. Yes, historic precedent. In the United States, 100 years ago, a third of American households were members of fraternal benefit organizations, mutual aid organizations. And they paid pennies a week to be members, to be owners of health cooperatives, which created their own hospitals, orphanages, old folks' homes, sanitaria, and which paid sickness and death benefits. So I have sought to rekindle that heritage in the United States, but have confronted authority, which seeks to maintain a monopoly, a corporate monopoly, on the provision of those basic services. And as I said before, that's part of the fun.
I've had this inkling here while we've been having this conversation that anybody who tries to maintain a status quo must be pretty nuts, really. It can't be maintained. No, nothing stays the same for too long, does it?
As the capitalist J.P. Morgan once said, I can employ half of the working class to kill the other half. And so you have
bureaucracies.
Yes?
What a psychopath.
Yes. And you have bureaucracies whose employees are committed to being middle class, who are dependent on banks for mortgages, for car loans, for health insurance, for student loans. They must have that income, even though when they go to work, they might know that they are part of the problem. The creating of pathways of alternatives is an essential part of the process of getting us all off that treadmill. The millions of people who depend on corporate incomes to do bad things must be assured that when they let go, that there is something else available. I've often characterized this as being like on a sinking ship. And the last people, the people are climbing the mast to be the last ones to sink. And they're kicking the people down below them on the mast so that they can be the last ones to sink. That's capitalism at its absolute worst. If you create a lifeboat, if you build a lifeboat and throw a line, then you know you don't need to kick each other. You don't need to compete to be the last one standing. But together, we can live. It's a very old story in human civilization. Competition and cooperation. Polarity, and defined within those polarities a society which enables us to be individualistic and competitive at the same time to thrive by cooperating. That is our essential challenge, I think. And the mutual enterprise society that I have promoted, I call it mutual enterprise, that is to say, neither strictly capitalistic, nor strictly socialistic, but a mutual enterprise society which celebrates...
That celebrates
enterprise,
what?
Initiative and creativity which serves community and nature.
Indeed. Well, I think that's a nice positive place to leave it, and gives you a rough general outline of the things that you're doing. So if you are in Philadelphia, ladies and gentlemen, hey, get in contact with Paul. His phone number's on his website there, paulglover.org. Paul, thank you very much for coming on the show today, man. It's been awesome.
Thank you, Vinny. Good to talk with you, too.
All right. And after the break, ladies and gentlemen, we will have a new guest coming at us for your listening pleasure as well, named Svi Maisanai, which should be talking about, I think, maybe Indonesian independence. I don't know. We'll find out. Back in a minute. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, which is great because Fukushima irradiated and everybody got a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb to save the economy. My very special guest, I'm not 100% sure on the pronunciation, but we've tried out. Is it Svi Maisanai?
Sinai.
Okay. I got it now. Do you have a website by chance?
Pardon?
Do you have a website?
Yes, yes. www.the-engagement.org.
Org. All right, bringing it up now. The-engagement.org. Okay, right. Well, we have a nice big peace dove there and a Star of David and a language that I cannot read.
No, you have to switch in the top right corner. There's an English and you switch to English.
I got it. I have switched to English. Okay, so you've made a book here, and you got some videos, and an alternative solution to the binational state. Could you really just give us a bit of a background or just on who you are and what you do for the audience's sake?
Yeah, I am the pioneer of the Israeli software industry. I learned physics, and then I was recruited to the army where I dealt with the computers, mainly software. And after I've done a lot of activity in that area and made several revolutions in software, I decided, when I saw the failure of the Oslo process, of the two-state direction, with the beginning of the Second Intifada, I have decided it's time to make a revolution here because just the plain approach of the two-state solution cannot happen. Despite the fact that if it happens, it's the best solution, it cannot happen. That's the main point. And that's why I looked for an alternative solution.
Okay, and what is your alternative solution?
Okay. Based on many studies, the two of them I made myself with help of others, it becomes clear that the vast majority of the Palestinians are Jews that remained in the country after the destruction of the temple, after the destruction of the Jewish independence 2,000 years ago, and were forced to convert to Islam. This is the majority of the people, which means
that the Palestinians are not Arabs by their nationality. They are only Arab by the culture of the occupier here. And from the national point of view, from their blood and origin, they are Jewish. That it comes as a main surprise, and it is astonishing, but there are many studies, including genetic studies and anthropological studies that I have done myself to a large extent, but previously others have done some work about it, especially the second president of Israel, Yitzhak Ben Tzvi. It shows that actually the Palestinians have nothing to do with being Arabs by nationality, by their origin. And based on this, the natural solution is to return these Palestinians to the people of Israel without forcing any religion on conversion on them, and create one state for one people, which means not two states for two people, not one state for two people, but one state for one people. This is the alternative solution.
Okay, well, this is flies in the face of what most people's common understanding is, that there's two very distinct racial groups and they've been at each other for, 50, 60 years or something of that nature, probably longer.
And
90 years, okay. Definitely longer then. And the perspective becomes that here's what I found about the situation. It's like both sides have gone nuts, okay? So one side is highly financed militarily wise, you know, the Israeli side by the United States, a couple of billion dollars a year in military hardware, as far as I know. And they use that military hardware on the other people, you know.
Use this expensive equipment on the Palestinians. They have nothing to fight with. And if there was nothing else except for the Palestinian, we could contribute to the American company much more than they are contributing to us.
Mm. And the other perspective that I find really silly is that there's these Palestinian extremists who will shoot rockets at these incredibly heavily armed Israelis, and lo and behold, 1,000 Palestinians will get killed in the attack back, you know? It's like both sides are freaking crazy.
Yeah, but you know, the main problem is not any extremist or any aggressiveness on one side or another. The main problem is Abu Mazen and his saying this is a Palestinian mafia that oppresses their own people. And they are getting few billions of dollars a year, and they are stealing half of the money and using only half of the money for the sake of the people. And they enjoy the situation. They don't want peace. The only thing that they want is to blame Israel for the misery that they're creating to their own people. And that's the main situation. Because Obama, for example, expects Abu Mazen to help create peace. But Abu Mazen is not interested in peace. His only interest is to blame Israel for the non-existence of peace and for the suffering of the Palestinian public, which was from the very beginning created by the Arab countries, mainly Syria, and the Palestinian leadership. They were never interested in the wellness of the Palestinian public. Always they look to steal money. I mentioned 90 years ago, The conflict started. It took time. People don't realize how old it is. Only because of greed. Nothing else. And this is what Abu Mazen continues now.
You say Abu Mazen. Who is that, a person or an organization? What is that?
You know, Abu Mazen is Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority.
Okay. And what's his background?
Oh, he was an engineer, but not a rich one. And he made the PhD thesis that suggests that the Holocaust was very minor, about 1 million Jews only were killed by the Nazis. But his main personal corruption is through his children. There was a report submitted to the U.S. Congress about the corruption of his sons that got a lot of money from the situation here. But he enables many others in their leadership to steal billions of dollars every year. And he replaced Arafat in the head of the Palestinian Authority. And he doesn't enable any solution here. But it's not him to blame in this. Arafat was the same. They are afraid to sign anything with Israel because Islam doesn't permit a Muslim leader to give up land that was controlled by Islam in the past. So they cannot afford to sign anything. Yasser Arafat, in the year 2000, when he was in Camp David with Ehud Barak, he was afraid to sign anything. We heard from his bodyguard that if Arafat would have signed anything, his bodyguard himself intended to kill him. Then we heard from an ambassador of Israel in Canada at the later stage that was part of this negotiation, Dr. Anand Baker, that Arafat treated him very nicely and told him, if I will sign anything, in 2 days I will be killed. So this is why they cannot afford to sign anything. And
Let me just see if I've got this straight. We can't bring peace to our people or our people will bring death to me.
Well, I was not able to understand. Please repeat.
Was basically the mentality here is, I'm sorry, we can't sign this deal that will bring peace to my people because my people will then kill me.
No, not my people, some extremists. Not the people.
But essentially, that's what we're talking about here, isn't it? You, by proxy, extremists are actually controlling the policy, aren't they?
In the Palestinian side, this is right, yes.
And are there extremists on the Israeli side as well that are also messing up the work? Because that was my contention, is that both sides are mired by parts of it that are run by extremists, and it's the extremists who are preventing the peace on both sides, whereas the majority of people just you want to get along and end the conflict. Is that about right?
Not on the Israeli side. On the Israeli side, there are extremists, but they're not controlling anything. And of course, Bibi Netanyahu doesn't want the two-state solution, but he cannot say it. And he uses the situation that the Palestinians refuse to sign in order to blame them, which means both sides are not interested in the two-state solution. But Obama presses both of them, and Europe assists. So what they're doing is just throwing mud on each other, blaming the other side for the situation. But it is the stupidity of the West that doesn't understand what happens here, that presses for the wrong solution, that prevents peace, which means the West mainly are the enemies of peace by insisting on a solution which is wrong and cannot happen, both wrong and cannot happen. Not that they are wanting to be the enemies of peace, but practically they are the enemies of peace, including the Israeli left that came with the stupid two-state solution idea. There is no place here for two states. With our direction, we are supported by most of the Palestinians that were exposed to our direction. And especially, they are frustrated and entirely in despair from their leadership, and they don't believe in any future of a Palestinian state, because a Palestinian state, because of some reason that I can explain later, it will be automatically corrupt. The Palestinian culture is a culture of corruption, and there's no way that a Palestinian state can survive. And it can only bring, as it already brought, misery for the Palestinian public. So many Palestinians, almost everyone that we speak with, are already convinced that the only solution is to be part of Israel, and as the Jews will not accept a binational state, and they know about the origin from the Jews, most of them, then they agree to our direction. We have many supporters in the Palestinian camp that are just praying to God that we will be successful with our direction.
I think that's a pretty reasonable idea. Okay. Well, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. We've got a break coming very shortly. And I had a very intense conversation with a Jewish friend of mine about this sort of thing, whereas previously I'd been completely on the Palestinian side, saying, oh, the oppressive Israeli administration regime, whatever you want to call it. And I found out that there really is two sides to this. And there's propaganda and madmen on both sides, I've found, you know. And I think what we're talking about here is bringing a bit of sanity and a bit of reality back to the debate. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. It's just a few minutes.
We got to change the way we see the problem if we're gonna fix this place. My living soul don't care about the color of your face. Unite and roll, respect our right to live here on the land. It's Tino Ranga, Tino Tonga, we don't know the banks. The parliament does so where'd you ever stand? They paying their bills off your back with hefty tax demands. Misleading now you with alcohol, TV, contrabands. So kids act up and...
Right, and we're back. We're back, ladies and gentlemen, with my very special guest, Zvi Meissenei, and his website is the-engagement.org, and if you're not an English speaker, there's a little button up in the top right-hand corner that you can click English to translate. Okay, so welcome back, and going over this whole scenario, the conflict's been going on for a long time, and in my opinion, any argument or conflict that goes on for a long time where there's no clear winner, it's usually because both sides are going about it wrong, and they just can't figure it out. What do you think?
Is it a question for me?
Yeah. Do you think both sides have just basically gotten it wrong this whole time, and throwing their lives away on meaningless insanity rather than simply going, you know what, it's not worth it fighting. Let's come together.
These are just symptoms. This is not the reason. On the Palestinian side, the main reason from the conflict from the very beginning, from 90 years ago until today, is corruption of their leadership. On the Israeli side, the main reason is ignorance about who really are the Palestinians. This is the problem, because the Palestinians don't have real leadership. They have only crooks or crazy Muslims, Muslim extremists as leaders. And this cannot bring peace, because in a situation of misery, there are people around the world, especially in the West, that are willing to pay money for peace. And at the moment that money is being given to these crooks for the sake of peace, they are stealing about half of it. That's on the Palestinian side. On the Israeli side, it is that difficult for the leaders to believe that their worst enemy for the 90 years is actually blood brothers, that now, after everything that happened, are yearning to, and even many of them in the past, but now it's much stronger, to return to the people of Israel and be part of it, because they are entirely ignorant of this, the situation can continue. All the other phenomena are just symptoms of this situation. And these are not the real cause of the problem. The real cause of the problem is that the world, especially the Israeli leadership, but also the West and many others, don't know the truth. You are speaking about the Freedom Radio. Truth brings freedom. And what we are missing is that the world will know that the truth, that Palestinians are not a people of their own. They are not, from the national point of view, they are not Arabs, only from the cultural point of view. From the national point of view, they belong to the historic people of Israel. And only after we realize this astonishing fact, then we can understand another totally different solution that will bring them back to our people and make us a bigger people here, bring us a peace, give the extremists on the Israeli side the complete land of the western side of the Jordan. Historically, also the eastern side of the Jordan was part of Israel, but we don't care about it now. What we need is peace, and peace can only happen with the entire western side of the Jordan being Israel and most of the Palestinian belonging, and it will be a process that will take about 40 years, belonging to the people of Israel. I mean, 40 years gradually. Each year, those that are more prepared to this will convert nationally, not without any religion, religious conversion, to the people of Israel.
Now, do you believe that Israel has a... you obviously believe that Israel has a right to exist, and there'd be other people saying, oh, well, I don't think there's anybody who has a right to exist. You either exist or you don't. And the fact is, they do. And my perspective on this is, look, you've got a conflict that's been going on for far too long, casualties on both sides, there's not enough security, people... obviously, an economy can't really flourish that well if it's fighting any kind of conflict. And I think this is also part of the reason for the economic collapse of the United States spending $2 billion a day in Iraq. And I was wondering how you felt about Israel's foreign policy, particularly that towards Iran and its so-called nuclear program.
Okay. Let me tell you very clearly. What the postponing of dealing with Iran that Obama is executing now, the postponement, is very dangerous because Iran is increasingly enriching more and more uranium for a higher and higher density. And they will not create an atomic bomb before they have enough enriched uranium, and they will spread it around Iran to places that nobody in the West, including Israel and the U.S., knows, and an attack on Iran will be impossible. And even if it will happen, they will be able, after an attack, to create enough bombs in order to somehow retaliate. So the current situation, as it continues, is very risky to the entire area and maybe even to the world. And we are just seeing the signs of what can happen with the crazy leadership of North Korea. So definitely, Netanyahu is right about demanding that something more serious will be done with Iran. I'm not saying that they must be attacked, but there must be an ultimatum to Iran to stop their enrichment of uranium. And about this, there's no question that Netanyahu is right, and Obama is like Chamberlain that enabled Hitler to take more and more parts in Europe. Chamberlain was the prime minister of the UK before Churchill. And he just permitted Hitler to take whatever he wants, and that's now what the West is permitting Iran. And so on the Iran side, there's no question that the Israeli leadership is right. But it's important to make peace here because Iran is using the misery and the problem here to justify the nuclear arsenal that they are preparing. And it is essential to create peace here. If peace here will stop Iran or not, I cannot tell you. But it is essential, even regardless of Iran, to finish the tragedy here. Both the interference to the Israeli economy and the misery of the Palestinian public. It is essential. You cannot imagine how bad is the situation in the Palestinian Authority. I can tell you, for example, in the past, the contributing countries paid money for the Palestinian Authority to buy drugs. And the Palestinian for the hospitals and other medical institutions in the Palestinian authorities, clinics and so on. But the Palestinian leaders stole, and their immediate subordinates stole most of the money. So they started giving the Palestinian authorities drugs. So on one hand, we know about, just as a sample, one guy that had hemorrhoids and was hospitalized, and an operation was made on him, and because there was not enough anesthetic, he just wake up in the middle of the operation. And on the other hand, the manager of the Palestinian Health Ministry was found to sell drugs that they got from the contributing countries in the free market, and putting 200 million shekels, more than $50 million, to his pockets. So this is just a sample to realize the Palestinian corruption, and some an example to understand the misery of the Palestinian public. They are on the verge of starving. They cannot buy drugs and so on when they need it, because, for example, one of the Palestinian employees that was working for the Palestinian Authority got 1 month 11 shekels, which is about $3 per month. And the only thing he could have bought with this is one pack of cigarettes.
Doesn't sound like a lot.
Okay, I there's no question, there's no need to buy the cigarettes, but he didn't buy them. He bought a bit of food for his family. There are many divorces occurring in the Palestinian authorities because the breadwinner cannot provide the bread.
Well,
the situation is horrible.
How the situation in Palestine is horrible?
Pardon, the situation in
Palestine.
There's no Palestine and Israel is the same thing. In the Palestinian Authority, the situation is horrible. Yes, the people are miserable because their leadership is stealing about half of the money, and the contributing countries are already fed up with this corruption, and they don't want to pay anything. Especially, there's no progress to peace, so why they have to pay for this mafia to steal the money, most of the money?
Because of this, the situation
is horrible. There's no future for any Palestinian independent economy. So they are depending on Israel, and because of their terror, they are not allowed to enter in Israel, to Israel and work here. So we brought many people from Thailand and from other places to replace them. So now, on the one hand, they are not getting what they are supposed to get as payroll from the Palestinian Authority because of the corruption. And on the other hand, many cannot work in Israel. There are some that can work in Israel. So they are left without a source of income. Now, there are tens of thousands that are working in the Israeli settlement, both building and in Israeli industry in the settlements. And now the Europeans want to make a boycott on Israeli products from the settlements, which means that tens of thousands of Palestinian breadwinners also will lose their work and their bread. So this is what the European left, and some of the Israeli left, not all of them, is planning to do. One factory was already closed in the settlement and was moved to within the Green Line. And the Israelis in the settlement can go to the Green Line and work there. But most of the Palestinians cannot do it. So not that already enough problem and misery for the Palestinians. Now, this initiative by the left in Europe and part of the left in Israel will add to the misery if it happens.
Well, can I ask as well, what kind of roadblocks are really in the way of this? Is there any outside influence? Because I do know that the United States is inextricably attached to Israel at the hip. You know, there's very many funding organizations, Anti-Defamation League, so on and so forth. Would the United States be opposed to getting Palestinians, which really of Jewish descent, as you've outlined here, becoming part of Israel? Or would they say, no, you're all terrorists, Israel, don't do it? I wonder. We'll find out after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Back in just a few minutes.
alone against your mad, deadly, worldwide, conspiratorial, gangster, computer god communism with wall-to-wall, deadly gangster protection, lifelong sworn conspirators murdering...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's the final segment today with my very special guest from the-engagement.org sphere, Mice and I. And we are talking about the Palestine-Israel conflict. The Palestine doesn't really exist. In fact, Palestinians don't really exist. They're all Jewish, of Jewish descent. And we're forced to commit... we're forced to convert to Islam way back in the day. And now there's a conflict, basically, from an entire people internally against themselves. Isn't that strange how history can suddenly make enemies of people who used to be blood brothers? That's weird. The other question is, as I went into over the break, is the massive connection between the United States and Israel, and what the pro-Israel lobbies in the United States would make of your assessment that Palestinians are, in fact, former Jews who were forcibly converted. How would they react to this this one-state solution that you're proposing?
If you're asking about the Israeli lobby, the answer is very simple. As Netanyahu declared that he is for the two-state solution, despite the fact that he's lying and justifying, with the full justification, he objects to this, but his official position that he's for it, and he knows that it cannot happen anyhow because of the other side. The Israeli lobby doesn't want to listen to any other thing because this is of the official policy of the government of Israel. And the same thing is the situation in Europe. We have supporters in the German parliament, for example, for our direction. But the Israeli ambassador is telling them that Israel is for the two-state solution. So what can they say? Now, President Obama heard about our findings and about the proposed solution. And he told us, I cannot say to the Jews and the Palestinians that they are blood brothers. It has to come from the local leaders. We'll support anything that will bring peace. But I cannot, as an American, I cannot say it. So what I am proposing, because despite that it sounds astonishing and very revolutionary and so on, because there's no progress, one millimeter, there's no progress in the direction of peace. Actually, it goes more backwards than forwards to try something else. And that President Obama will discuss with Israeli leaders that are at the moment, I mean mainly Netanyahu, are reluctant even to meet with us because it sounds that revolutionary. He will press them to examine this proposal. We have some supporters in the Israeli government, but it's not enough. So we hopefully not the Israeli lobby, but the American leadership has to force the Israeli government to examine an alternative. That's all. Once people will start speaking about it, it will be a snowball. Because the people on both sides are yearning for peace. This is just such an astonishing direction that the people are... Don't believe that this is possible. But speaking about it and discussing it will make it, in the media, will make it possible. Because people will understand that this is something viable just because speaking about it and hearing the reaction of most of the people on both sides.
What about the general public? I would assume that it would require mass media attention in order to inform people of the truth about this scenario and that the conflict has just been going on for really no good reason, and that the Palestinian Authority is corrupt and taking the Palestinians' wealth and keeping them down. And it makes me wonder, is there somebody like an intelligence operation going on here, like, I don't know, backing the Palestinian Authority from the Israeli side to keep the Palestinians down or anything like that?
No. There is a backing of the Palestinian Authority by the Israeli government to some extent in order to prevent the Hamas from taking over. Not in order to create a misery. We are the main victims of this misery because we are being blamed for that misery. So there's no conspiracy to that extent. The only conspiracy that exists is the corruption. But the main problem is not this corruption. The main problem is that the truth is not known. Many Palestinians know the truth. But among the Israelis, it is even if people heard about it, most of them and many people in Israel know about what we are doing, but most of them don't believe it because about revolution, about revolutionary direction, you have to hear more and more in order to believe. Initially, if you are speaking about 20 years ago or 30 years ago, nobody in Israel almost nobody in Israel supported the direction of the two states. But as it became, more and more people spoke about it, and the Israeli, part of the Israeli leadership supported it, It was discussed in the media. People got used to the idea. And the same thing, to some extent, must happen here. But in order for the media to speak about it, some of the leaders, of the Israeli leaders, must not only support it silently in government meetings or in some internal discussions, but they have to speak about it. And then it can happen, because we have many supporters in the Palestinian Authority, and if Israel will just open a small window, such a wind will enter the Palestinian camp that either Mahmoud Abbas will have to support it or will be replaced.
Back him into a corner and force peace. Isn't that interesting? You can make something happen just by forcing it to happen. And the problem is, well, the interesting irony is really that most of the times that we force things to happen, it creates conflict. We're talking about really creating an ultimatum whereby peace is the only outcome, right?
This doesn't break peace. The U.S. has given an ultimatum to Mubarak to step down, and the situation in Egypt deteriorated. Europe has given ultimatum to the Turkish army, and now we got Erdogan that believes that he is the Mahdi, and he has to create problems everywhere. The West has given ultimatum to the Iranian Shah about 30 years ago that he has to step down, and we got the crazy Islam in Iran. There's no point in making ultimatums for the sake of peace. First thing, If somebody wants to do something, he has to learn the facts. What is behind the situation? Not just the symptoms, the reason for the current situation. And in the, for example, in the Arab countries, the problem were not the dictators. And democracy is by no means a solution. The problem in the Arab countries is the ignorance and illiteracy of a major part of the people. This is the problem. And before we can speak about democracy there that will bring any good, you have to make sure that the people will not be ignorant and will not be illiterate. That's much more basic before you can suggest democracy. And there's more to say about democracy, but it's not important now. If democracy is well defined as the least worst solution, but humanity has to get something better. Winston Churchill spoke tens of years ago that in order to understand the weakness of democracy, it's enough to speak for 5 minutes with the average voter. So democracy is not in any case a good solution, but in a place that there is ignorance and illiteracy, and any extremist can sell any lies to the majority of the people and get control of the country, like it happens in Egypt, there is no room for democracy. Democracy is damaging. And this is what the West enforced on Egypt, that make Egypt a major victim to this. And so there's no issue.
We've run out of time, unfortunately. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to look at his website, the-engagement.org. We'll see you again sometime.